The people who didn't get the email, could you email me? So is there anybody who did not get the email? Okay, can you send me an email that says that? And I'll put you on. But first, let me ask if there are any questions, discussions from last time or previous time. Yes? I see somebody raising their hand. Yes. That's you. Do you want to remind us what, sorry, do you want to remind us what Corollary 5 is? Okay. Okay. Good, good. But so 2 points. One, because what I'd like to do is postpone the discussion of this again. I have something in mind. I sent, I hope everybody, the paper of Demoto, I think it is, that I was sent by you guys, Newton's unpublished paper. Did everybody get that? And then also this paper of Euler. Did people get that? I see some blank faces. Okay, I should go back to my email about that. Okay. But in any case, you know, there are two things, there are three things at issue for raising Newton and Leibniz. Okay. So one is
just to have a frame of reference to introduce language about relationalism versus other things, which I think I did, and is sort of invariant under getting the history right, because mythology is sufficient to get the nomenclature right. Two is the complexity of how Newton was actually thinking and how Leibniz was actually thinking, but I think in a sense Newton is more important because Newton is the person who made a form of dynamics that was usable and that was successful. And what I'm interested in and what I want to come back to, so what I'd like to suggest is that people read those papers, especially the Newton, which I think is fascinating, and we come back to have a discussion about Newton, which is a kind of discussion about the relationship between what arguments from principle lead you to, and what the possibilities of the time scientifically allow. And in my own thinking, I keep coming back to this phrase of Einstein, in which he praised Newton for the courage and wisdom to employ absolute space, whatever precise notion, doesn't matter, because it let him move ahead and formulate a form of dynamics that was useful and where you could just start solving problems. Whereas even if one accepts a philosophical argument for relationalism or something like it, I mean, we see even from the discussions we've had about observables and general relativity that general relativity is much harder to work with than Newtonian mechanics. And so there's a sort of interplay there. And I'm very personally suspicious of being, it's possible just to be comfortable with the dichotomy and say that what's practical is not going to be the same thing as what seems preferable in principle. But I'm very uncomfortable with that. I have a sense that if something works easily in the realization of it, there's probably some good reason. And if something is, you know, sounds nice to say, but it's very difficult to formulate anything observable precisely, we have a problem. So if it's okay, that's the discussion I'd like to come back to. And when I come back to it, I'd like to discuss really the subtlety of, you know, was Newton confused or not confused about absolute rest or not? Because I suspect, and you guys know better, that it's relevant for what Newton was able to do at different times. Yeah, please go ahead. Do you think it would? Does somebody want to comment on that? Yeah. Can you guys hear us? Yeah, okay.
Like in the long term, they will, you know, there's some friction effect due to the dissipation of gravitational waves, so they would actually like rotate together. By the time the bullet is infinitely far away and you have kind of completely forgotten about the initial conditions, which is basically a shooting rifle, by that time they will, you know, should rotate in phase, and then. Then it's again kind of a relative system.
Well, but it's not. Can I comment? So at the beginning of this class, in the first lecture, I made a distinction between cases with boundaries like the asymptotically flat case and the contact case without boundary, and certainly. In the case with boundaries of the asymptotically flat case, the general relativity is not, I don't know if I would call it absolutist, but it's not purely relational, it's not purely diffeomorphic invariant. And if it would help this, let me just sort of say technically what intervenes. And this is actually relevant for what I'm going to be talking about today. Because the holographic principle is, in some problematic way, about observables made on boundaries. So you know, in the compact, and by that I mean spatially compact case, the space-time manifold is some free manifold cross time, and that free manifold has no boundary. So there's no place to put observers, there's no place to put boundary conditions. And the diffeomorphism invariance is really the gauge group, gauge in the sense that we've described, is the whole diffeomorphism group of the manifold. In the asymptotically flat case, and I didn't come prepared with the technical details, but one does something like the following, and I'm a little bit embarrassed because sitting out there at dinner is Bob Garoche, who is responsible for some of the most elegant and precise formulations of the asymptotically flat case. So I hope he doesn't hear me. I was a postdoc in that group, and they know very well how unmathematical I am.
But it is something like the following. Sigma 3 let's just take it to be R3 to make things simpler. There, that can be relaxed a little bit so that there's a external region of sigma 3, which is R3. And then you consider on this R3, and I'm going to draw it as if we'd use some conformal map to bring its boundaries in. So R3 is now R is now this piece of the plane. And one takes out some compact region, let's call it C, and considers R3 minus C. Because it's, the point is it only matters what happens in the neighborhood of the boundary. And on R3 minus 3, you choose a flat metric, which we'll call, I guess what I mean is on times process, you choose a flat four-dimensional metric. Let's call it eta mu nu, which means that in, and we choose some coordinates such that ds squared is dt squared minus dx squared minus dy squared minus dz squared in this neighborhood of infinity. And No, I'm distinguishing the two cases. That's the compact case. Sorry. And now I'm talking about the asymptotically flat case. And I'm distinguishing it. And I want you to be impressed by the amount of structure we introduce to even define it. Okay. And so what I've done is in a neighborhood of infinity, I've introduced a flat metric and I've introduced some flat coordinates. So there's in particular a radial coordinate, such that dr squared is dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And notice I'm not saying I've introduced a diffeomorphism equivalence class of flat metrics. I've introduced a flat metric, a particular one. And then the statement is that a metric g, what coordinates am I using? G mu nu is asymptotically flat if on this region of R3 minus the compact region, it has the form of eta mu nu plus terms of order 1 over R. And in some formulations, one is even rather specific about the form of the first few terms of order 1 over R. For example, one might have something of the form of the spatial part of the metric QAB is delta AB plus just a constant over R plus terms of order 1 over R squared. And so one considers then a one considers then two things. One of them is a configuration space of such metrics. And the point is, notice that I've broken diffeomorphism invariance, so there is a particular flat metric in this region, and I'm using its radial coordinate, a particular coordinate, which is a radial coordinate relative to a particular flat metric, to define what I mean by going to, in other words, now at any point in this region, you know what is R equals constant, and you can study taking R very large, and then you constrain. I mean, there are better ways that this thing is said. One says something like g mu nu minus eta mu nu in that coordinate. Absolute value is bounded by some constant over R. And therefore, you define a class of metrics which have a behavior which breaks the diffeomorphism invariance. So one has broken the gauge symmetry, one has broken the diffeomorphism invariance, and now the gauge group is not all diffeomorphisms, but only diffeomorphisms that respect this asymptotic structure. And so I don't remember how that's said, but it's something like any diffeomorphism phi goes to the identity as R goes to infinity. That's what's meant morally. I don't remember how precisely that's expressed. But and again, there are very elegant ways that these things are expressed that have been developed that I'm not going to try to reproduce here. So the whole structure of general relativity is explicitly broken to define what we mean by an asymptotically flat spacetime. Now, once this is done, Mach's principle is not satisfied. So I guess we haven't mentioned Mach's principle, but I hope everybody knows roughly what Mach's principle is. It's the idea that the local inertial frames locally in some region of spacetime are, quote, determined by the distribution and overall motion of matter, so that, as the saying goes, if you were to rotate all the stars and galaxies overhead, we would feel precisely as dizzy than if we rotate with respect to the stars and galaxies. And of course, Mach formulated that at a time when it wasn't relativistic physics yet. And one can argue about whether general relativity, by being relational in the senses that I discussed previously, for the compact case, is, quote, Machian or, quote, Leibnizian. But it certainly is neither under any construction in this asymptotically flat case. On the other hand, in the asymptotically flat case, the question of observables becomes very easy. So for example, M, this constant, is invariant. So let me try to give this thing a name. So the gauge group is, let's call them restricted diffeos. So the constant M, which is called the mass of the spacetime, is invariant under the restricted diffeos. So it, in fact, is an observable. And other quantities, which you can pull off the leading terms in the expansion of the metric, correspond to the total momentum of the spacetime, and under certain conditions and not under others, the angular momentum. And again, under certain conditions, detailed conditions and not others, you even get an infinite number of multiple moments. At least that's true in the stationary case, where there's a time-like killing field. So you get, for your troubles, a lot of observables which measure what an observer very far away from the physical system, that is far enough away from whatever stars and galaxies and so forth are going on in here, that there is a flat metric that you can find such that the metric has this form. There are things that you would observe as a distant observer, and they are expressible in terms of components that you can pull off an expansion of the metric. Yes, Sean.
Do you think it's absolutely necessary to use this as a criterion for asymptotic flatness? I mean, could you use put some bound on the Ricci curvature tensor or something, or Ricci scalar, which that would be?
So the answer is, I don't know. And what I discussed is crude, and a lot of very elegant work was done in the 1960s and 1970s about the precise definition, the most useful definitions of asymptotic flatness. And I'm not prepared to discuss that here, and it's not relevant for what we're doing. There are a lot of different kinds of definitions that were considered, and what I'm discussing is an approach which was useful and which is still useful and allows a lot of results to be derived. There are mathematically very elegant means of doing this, but I've said that about six times. So is that clear? So it's possible. So I don't know that we would even. It's an interesting question to what extent this is the same theory as the compact case. This is a way, I think, to best understand this is if you believe that general relativity is the right theory of nature and you want to study an isolated system, such as the gravitational field of a star or a solar system or a galaxy, you invent an approximate theory which allows you to easily handle the problem of what's an observable, allows you to easily compute observables. For example, this is what people do in numerical relativity. If you want to study two black holes and neutron stars in orbit spiraling around each other, losing energy, coalescing, and so forth, all of this is done in terms of observables that make sense in the asymptotically flat case, which is approximately realized in numerical calculations. But I would make the claim that this is an approximation to a claim for fundamental theory in order to discuss an isolated system. And the fact that it is not satisfactory philosophically is not surprising because it's constructed to deal with a very special kind of case. So my sense is that so Brands and Dickey then made an argument from this, which I think is a fallacious argument, but it was for a while a very influential argument. And maybe you can correct me because I'll be doing this from memory, but basically Brands and Dickey said, well, let's think of a variation of general relativity which won't have this issue. So they considered an action which was the integral of the usual action for general relativity, but they added a scalar field, or scalar field squared. I guess they just added a scalar field there. So that, and remember that Newton's constant is sitting here, so it's kind of making Newton's constant proportional to a field that can vary. And then they added a parameter, I forget what it's called, but let's call it eta, square root of g mu nu del mu phi, so that phi has some sources plus the Lagrangian for the rest of the matter, degrees of freedom. And the idea was that the gravitational force and field partly is determined by the scalar field, because you can think of the scalar field as renormalizing the value of the Newton's constant, and that can vary from place to place as a solution. So it's making the gravitational force more relational. There is no more fixed constant which tells you what the strength of the gravitational field is. And this is a theory. Did I get that roughly right? The parameter of the field. Omega, there. Yeah, and there was some, and there's some dependence of phi also in the matter action, which I don't remember. And then a game was played where from observations inside the solar system, omega was bounded to be either much, to be some ridiculous number, which I don't know what it was. Yes. 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 Right. So I vaguely remember this history. Okay, so two questions, then I'm going to go on. Yes?
Just two quick things. There's no dependence of the meta-Lagrangian on the scalar field.
Okay.
They wanted it to be gravitational and to only indirectly couple to meta and by a coupling to the metric.
Okay, thank you.
And it's not completely falsified. It's only that Kalman would have to be bigger than 40,000 in order to be still in accord.
With gamma is the same thing as omega?
Yeah, sorry, I meant omega.
Yeah, 40,000. Okay.
Although this theory is the strongest principle for any value.
Yeah, I did not come prepared to get an argument about it. But this is a good setup, so if you let me, what I propose to do is we all look at this unpublished notes of Newton, which I think really are fascinating, and I'll send an email either next time or the time after. We'll come back and have a discussion about this. I want to hold your breath. We're going to take a segue to the late 20th century to an idea which was once thought to be as promising as Franz-Dicke theory. And now is in a rather confused state, which is the holographic principle. And the reason why I want to talk about the holographic principle is that it has within its confused attempts at formulations some ideas about what is an observable in a quantum theory of gravity, which are quite radical and which I think it's worth our while to think through. So if that's OK, I'm going to segue to that. Is that fine? OK. So I don't hear any. Pab Namabin has a version. I didn't send his papers around. The papers which are usually associated with the holographic principle are two papers, one by Gerard et Hooft, which I sent around from about 93, and one shortly after by Leonard Susskind, I think also 1993, The World as a Hologram. For reasons that I hope will become clear as we talk, a series of papers by Lewis Crane, actually starting about a year earlier in 1992, although the one I sent around was from 95, have a very interestingly complementary set of ideas. And so I'd like to talk about these. And what I'd like to do is provide some motivation and then look at the paper of Et Hooft,
And I really, these papers I think really are worth reading. And the paper of Crane, the one from 95 that I sent around, which has the most complete formulation of his ideas about this. So this is an idea which was born of several people at about the same time. Susskind's formulation, which he tied closely to string theory, was very influential because it was inspirational of work of Maldacena, which I also sent you in 97, I believe. 96? Okay. And which is what now is sometimes called the ADS CFT correspondence. And I won't discuss that much today, but I will like to come back and discuss that. Crane's formulation has been very influential because it inspired works which are now called the isolated horizon picture. These are a series of works within loop quantum gravity about how to treat black holes and cosmological horizons. And these have been very influential. Although it may not be apparent at first sight, that is, and I'll explain how Lewis Crane's ideas became evolved into what became the isolated horizon picture. Etov's ideas have not been very influential, which is interesting. And one of the questions I'd like us to be asking is why. A main reason is that his proposal is explicitly couched within a denial of the adequacy of conventional quantum mechanics. That is, part of a tough story, as we'll talk about it, is that quantum mechanics must be essentially wrong. And he advocates a very interesting type of hidden variable theory as part of the proposal. And so therefore, even though there's a good argument that Etov is one of the great living scientists on the planet, and certainly his work in particle physics, it's hard to think of anybody who was more influential of what became the standard model of particle physics and more influential of how string theory has developed than Gerard Etov. But nonetheless, because he dissents from quantum mechanics, his work has not been very influential in the same way. But nonetheless, he was the origin. Well, Crane and Etov were independent. Susskind was a sabbatical visitor in Utrecht, where Etov is, and learned about the ideas from Etov and reinterpreted Etov's ideas sort of while Etov was formulating them in the language of string theory. So, and this is a set of ideas that many of us have believed were the discovery of a principle or even the principle that could underlie quantum gravity, the new principle which defines what is the quantum theory of gravity. And nonetheless, although there's been a lot of influence of these ideas, and a certain version has a lot of evidence for its realization, that's the Maldacena conjecture, nonetheless, nothing like what either Etov or Crane or even Susskind, I think, had in mind originally, but certainly what Etov had in mind originally and what Crane had in mind originally has been realized. So I think it's an essential set of ideas for us to look at in this course. And so what I'd like to do is start with the sort of basic motivation. And let me start here. And compare it to the asymptotically flat case. And then we'll look at the papers and see exactly how they formulated that. So I have not taught here black hole physics. So let me review the very basic physics of black holes in general relativity, and particularly in the context where there's general relativity plus some quantum field theory on a fixed background. And we'll consider the two cases separately. So I hope people are not bored by this. This is just some basic background to make sure we're all up to speed on the background, because this was the motivation for both Atulf and Crane, was the issues about black holes and entropy and information. Okay. So in about 1972, Jacob Bekenstein made a conjecture that a black hole has entropy. And the entropy of a black hole is the area over h bar g. And remember, h bar g is the Planck length squared. Okay, times some numerical constant. And I certainly recommend that paper for people who haven't read it. It was written when he was a graduate student of John Wheeler's, and it's one of the most influential papers in this, I don't know how you'd say, in the second half of the 20th century. And it's a beautiful paper. It's very, the argumentation is very simple, and it basically consists of the query that if I have a black hole, there appears to be possible violations of the second law for the region of spacetime outside the black hole. Because I can take a box with thermal radiation, and that has an entropy of roughly the volume of the box times the temperature cubed. And I can throw, so let's call that S of the box, and I can throw the box into the black hole. And therefore, there's been a change in the entropy in the region outside the black hole, which is minus VT cubed. And as long as, R, let's say the size of the box, V to the 1/3, is much less than the Schwarzschild mass of the black hole, I can reason about that, and one can do calculations, the first order and perturbation theory in classical general relativity. And indeed, the box is captured by the black hole. And therefore, the second law of thermodynamics seems to be violated, because I've taken some entropy, put it in a box, and thrown it where it can never be seen again. Yeah. There are coordinate systems. Okay. Where, let's be careful about that. There are coordinate systems where there are time coordinates with respect to which the box never crosses the horizon. And there are time coordinates on the space-time where the box does cross the horizon in a finite time. What is true is that as the box falls into the black hole, light signals leaving the box closer to the horizon are delayed more and more asymptotically in the limit that you approach the horizon, so that there's a probability that an observer far away, arbitrarily late, would detect a photon from the box. And therefore, it can be claimed, yes, the point you make can be claimed and was claimed.
Yeah, no, no, that point was claimed, but I think, but there seems to be a better response, which was Beckenstein's suggestion, which I'm coming to.
It's also true that you need the back reaction problem for that, that the presence of that box can disturb the space-time, and so that argument's not.
I'm coming for that. Let me come over here. What I'm going to say is hand waving and rough, but Beckenstein's response was, well, wait a minute. The box has a mass, which is roughly the volume times t to the fourth, which is the energy in the box. And the black hole mass, which we assume is much greater than the mass of the box, changes. So there's a change in the mass of the black hole, which is roughly given by that. And you can argue about whether you can slowly drop the box in and lead the energy off so it doesn't go into the black hole. There's a lot of ifs, ands, or buts, but let's, to simplify the discussion, we just stand some distance, we drop the thing in, it goes in, and the mass of the black hole increases. Therefore, the entropy, which for a short-shell black hole, the area is related to the short-shell mass squared, which is related to the mass squared. So there is a delta A, which goes like the mass of the black hole times delta the mass of the black hole, which is positive. And I think I'll leave it. I could try to fix up the constant. But what Jacob Beckenstein argued is that because of quantum mechanics, you see there's an H-bar here. And you have to get an H-bar into the problem. Okay? And to get an H-bar into the problem, you have to argue that if there's anything in the box, the wavelength, which goes like 1 over the temperature, has to be less than the size, I called it R, the size of the box, and there's some H-bars there. So there's an H-bar in the problem. And we'll leave it as an exercise to show that there, no matter how you fiddle with it and try to minimize the S or minimize the energy, the result is that you can show that delta A, I'm sorry, if you define delta S of the black hole as delta A times the dimensionless constant over H bar G, that this is always greater than or roughly equal to the entropy of the box. So Jacob's proposal is that there should be a generalized entropy, which is the entropy outside the black hole, plus the entropy of the black hole, which satisfies a generalized second law that it always stays the same or increases in time. Okay. And I'll leave it as an exercise to fix up the constant and convince yourself that because of that H bar, you can't get around this sound. Now, of course, this is what I'm given as a hand-waving argument, and Beckenstein's original paper is not much. The core of it is this hand-waving argument, but it's been a very influential argument.
in order that something like the second law of thermodynamics be true, one should associate an entropy with the area of the horizon of a black hole. Now, there's another piece of evidence for this, and I'm ashamed to say that I don't remember the historical sequence. But there's a theorem of Hawking in classical general relativity that in any process in classical general relativity, the sum over the black holes in the problem of the areas of the black holes, the change in that is always greater than or equal to zero. So there was already an idea, and I think this was a bit before Bekenstein's work, but not much before Bekenstein, that the area of a horizon just in classical general relativity has a property reminiscent of area. That is, you can, if you take two black holes, they have a certain sum of their areas of horizons, you merge them into a new black hole, and that whatever happens, the area of the final black hole cannot be less than the sum of the areas of the two original black holes, and so forth. And this is a theorem in classical general relativity. By the way, just to see if you're listening, general relativity is a time reversal invariant theory. Where does the direction of time come from? In Hawking's theorem. Hawking's theorem says that there's an irreversibility in solutions to classical Einstein's equations. How is that possible? Because the Einstein's equations are reversible under the time coordinate going to minus the time coordinate.
No.
Does this make sense, Richard?
No.
Isn't the black hole merger kind of a nonlinear process?
No. There's a much simpler reason where the time.
It just fixes a timeline congruence, does it?
No.
Number of black holes?
No.
Time fails to exist?
No. Think. Out there in Western, any? Okay. As was first realized by David Finkelstein in a beautiful paper, the notion of a black hole itself is not time reversal invariant. The notion of a black hole horizon is that it is related, a horizon is related to the past of scribe plus. That is, a horizon is the boundary of a region that cannot send light signals moving into the future to future infinity. And so that the definition of a black hole breaks the symmetry of time reversal invariant. An object, a region that cannot send light signals backwards in time to infinity in the minus t direction is called a white hole. Yes?
Okay, so wouldn't you be able to just create a generalized theorem combining black holes and white holes? And then don't you need cosmic censorship in order to get a time-like direction then?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
Because cosmic censorship is basically just no white holes, right?
That's one version.
Okay.
I have not thought in that direction, so I don't know.
Okay.
Okay, so is it clear? So black holes themselves are a... and by the way, that paper, I mean, I'm just throwing this out. It's not relevant to what we're doing, but there's this brilliant paper of David Finkelstein. I don't have a reference, but it's Physical Review 1959. It has the word Leibniz in the title. Okay, so David was thinking about relationalism and Leibnizianism, and he discovered what you've learned in a general relativity course, hopefully, as Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, are the coordinates that make clear that the surface of the horizon is that the r equals 2m surface is a, what we now call a horizon, that is a surface that things moving from the past to the future can cross only in one direction. That's another indication that a black hole is time asymmetric, because you can fall into it but you can't come out of it. That's a time asymmetric fact. And David Finkelstein was the first person to understand that R equals 2m in the Schwarzschild solution is not a singularity, but was a null surface that could only be crossed one way. And that's a beautiful paper to read. And it's remarkable that that took until 1959. That until the 1959, there was not a correct notion of what a black hole was. Even though Eddington, in the 1930s probably, had written down the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, he had not understood what they meant, apparently. Okay. So Hawking's classical theorem suggested the identification of the area of a black hole with entropy, and there was also a theorem in classical general relativity called the first law of black hole mechanics that said that if you considered some adiabatic changes to a black hole solution, there was a relationship between delta of the mass of the energy and a quantity called the surface gravity of the black hole and delta of the area of the black hole, where this is something called surface gravity of the black hole. It's basically sort of how much, if you're not exactly at the horizon, but close to the horizon, you take the limit into the horizon, how much acceleration you feel standing there. And so this is a classical GR result. And that was in the literature. And indeed, if you want some other terms associated with delta angular momentum, there's a thing that multiplies delta angular momentum and so forth, but I won't confuse us by worrying about that. And this, of course, is suggestive of the first law of thermodynamics, and several people responding to Bekenstein said it's a very close match because there already is this law. If the area is like the entropy, the mass is the energy. The only problem is that nothing can come out of a black hole, so the temperature of a black hole is zero. So there's not a good analogy. It's close, but because nothing can come out of a black hole, it's not a good analogy.
I can ask a thing about the Bekenstein argument. Mm-hmm. Like, the whole Gauss-Bach, I mean, what is going against the argument?
I didn't really give the argument. The argument is, you might imagine that if the entropy, where is it? Here. You might imagine that you can make the box really small and make delta S arbitrarily small, or make the box really large and make delta S really large. Okay, because the entropy and the energy go like different powers of the temperature. So you might imagine that you could squeeze things in such a way that you could put in the box more entropy. Here's what you might do. You might consider T low and V big and try to squeeze a situation where you put in very little entropy but a lot of mass, so you violate the second law. Or I'm sorry, I mean the other way. T low and, what do I mean? T big and V small. I want to make the entropy I'm throwing in large, but the mass small, okay? So relatively to some fixed constant, say the Schwarzschild radius, that's V small and T large. Okay. But there's a bound, I can't make V too small, or there won't be any photons in the box at all, even if, quote, the temperature is large. Okay. And that's where H bar comes in. And if you play around with what you can do, trying to get away to break the bound, you discover the formula in the box.
If you make the box too small, you get a black hole. Right. And that's where you get the prime bound.
No, it's if you make the box too small, it can't contain a photon of the temperature T. Because the temperature would have to be higher because the wavelength is smaller.
Well, I think what Sean's saying is that if you take the photons out of it and just say, I want this much entropy or this much energy in a small space, then you have to have a black hole at a certain temperature.
Yeah, okay. There is that side of it as well. There is that side of it as well. Thank you. There is that side of it as well. I know I'm murdering it. You know the argument much better than that. So this is where things stood for a year or two, and then apparently several people had the same idea that roughly at the same time, Paul Davies, Anu, and Steve Hawking, but Steve Hawking found out the way to calculate it and get the value. The idea is that the temperature is not zero because by quantum effects, radiation leaks out of the black hole and it's thermal, and the temperature goes like the Planck mass squared over the mass of the black hole. Neglecting all dimensions, all constants. All of a sudden, and indeed, this is some constant times the surface gravity of a black hole. So the correspondence to the second law becomes believable because the correspondence to the first law of thermodynamics becomes perfect. That is, you really can read Hawking's theorem as an aspect of the generalized second law of thermodynamics, and you really can realize this first law of black hole mechanics as the first law of thermodynamics. If you say that a black hole is an object that has an entropy and has a temperature. And that's how these ideas came together. And I apologize for not writing the 1/4 and everything. When you put the right constants in, then the alpha becomes 1/4. And Bekenstein was not able to fix that constant. Hawking was able to fix the constant because of the relationship between temperature and the surface gravity of a black hole, which he was able to derive from a study of a quantum scalar field on the spacetime of a black hole.
Now, this was in 1974, 1975, so this is more than 30 years ago. At the time, there was a strong feeling that something deep had been discovered. And what's interesting, if you want to have a sense of wonder about it, okay, notice that these two results, which are analogous to the second law and the first law of thermodynamics, are theorems of classical general relativity. As soon as you take the field equations of classical general relativity, so there's nothing statistical, there's nothing thermodynamic, it's classical general relativity, you put in a time irreversible notion, which is the object of a black hole, the definition of a black hole, which is time irreversible, and you pull from the study of the solutions that have black holes in it, of the Einstein equation, results which are analogous to the first and second law of thermodynamics. And indeed, there's one which is also analogous to the third law, but let's not complicate things by discussing it right now. Okay. And that in itself is remarkable and puzzled people. Then you add a little quantum mechanics, first in the form of this hand-waving argument, more precisely by studying a quantum field on the background of a space-time describing a Schwarzschild black hole. Okay. And you develop the identification of the surface gravity up to constants with the temperature. So you discover a black hole has radiation and the entropy with the area. Okay. And all of a sudden, these solutions to Einstein's equations plus a little bit of quantum mechanics have become thermodynamic objects. Okay. And I emphasize thermodynamic objects. There's as yet no statistical mechanics. If you believe in Boltzmann, Gibbs, Einstein's view of the world, the laws of thermodynamics are approximate, emergent, macroscopic laws which follow from the statistics of large numbers of degrees of freedom, then the question arises, what is the statistical ensemble that corresponds to a black hole, the log of whose degeneracy is proportional to its area and Fonkiness? Because if you believe in statistical mechanics, you don't believe that there should be objects which just have entropy and temperature and are not statistical ensembles of many degrees of freedom. And that question suggests a couple of things. First of all, it needs an answer. And in different ways, in very different ways, in a class of examples, string theory has provided an answer in a class called extremal and near extremal black holes. In another class of examples, weak quantum gravity has provided an answer. So within particular approaches to quantum gravity, there are now on the table proposals for answers. And another approach to quantum gravity, there are discussions of possible answers. It also suggests even more, and suggested to people at the time, that there's maybe some very deep connection between quantum physics, gravitational physics, and statistical physics, that these three things are deeply interrelated in some hidden way. Okay. So, and many of us, I was a graduate student. I started graduate school a few years after all this work, and this stuff was very much in the air and continues to be in the air. I haven't yet gotten to the holographic principle, but let me jump ahead. And what I'd like to do is, if it's okay with everybody, is to sort of present the motivation for and some possible statements of the holographic principle, and then we take a break, and then we come back and look at what these people are saying in their papers, where they proposed it. Let me notice, however, just to set it up before I leave this, that there's more than one thing that you could mean by the entropy of a black hole, and this will matter. Okay. So you could mean by the statement that the entropy of a black hole is the area over 4G H bar. You could mean by this that E to the black hole entropy is, quote, the number of degrees of freedom in the black hole. Or dimension of the Hilbert space of the system of the black hole. And let's call that the strong version of the statement. That is, that whatever a black hole is, it has something which is made from some degrees of freedom. And the entropy is roughly, can be considered to be the log of the number of degrees of freedom, or the log of the dimension up to a factor of log 2 of the Hilbert space of the system. And one might take the entropy of a black hole to be such, a description of the degrees of freedom that make up the black hole. Or one might take E to the entropy of the black hole. No, one might just take the entropy of the black hole to be the amount of information, because we know classically classical and quantum statistical mechanics is a relationship between entropy and information. The amount of information measurable just over the horizon. That is, I imagine I have some measuring instruments. I arrange them in a sphere. I bring a scaffolding of measuring instruments down close to the horizon of the black hole. And I ask, how much information can I distinguish by making measurements at the surface of the black hole? How large of a Hilbert space do I need to code all the possible results? How many different orthogonal states do I need to code all the possible measurements that I can make at the surface of a black hole? Okay, or E to the S black hole is dimension, I'd like to put it that way, is number of orthogonal states needed to describe measurements made at the horizon. Okay, and we can call this the weak notion of black hole entropy. Okay. Is that clear? Is that distinction clear? And it matters hugely for the 30 years of debates that follow. Now let's skip a little bit ahead. While we're skipping ahead, there are two things of note just to mention. One of them is that there's a huge debate about something called the black hole information paradox. And that roughly is that if you believe in the strong version and you make a black hole and it radiates, it loses energy, it's shrinks because the Schwarzschild radius is proportional to the mass, so the horizon area is proportional to the mass squared. It radiates, it has a much smaller horizon, therefore it has a much smaller entropy. And you can ask what's happened to the information in the black hole. You can throw into the black hole all kinds of stuff. It just radiates thermal radiation. You can ask what happens to that information as the black hole radiates, and whether that question is a constraint on its ultimate fate. Because the radiation is a semi-classical effect. Does it radiate all the way down to about the Planck scale and just stop there and freeze there? Does it completely whoop disappear so it's no longer there? And there's 30-some years of argument about that. The bright light in the whole argument is a paper by Jacobson, and I'm just mentioning this in passing, which is the Einstein equations as an equation of state. And I'd like to come back and discuss this. I think it's sort of the to one bright light in the whole subject between 1976 and 1993. But it would take the rest of the time to discuss it. Okay. So now we come to 1993. And it took, and I strongly recommend reading this paper, it took says the following. Supposing I have a box in which I want to study the physics. And the box has a volume V equals R cubed. And I want to know how many degrees of freedom are there in the box. Okay, I set aside, and you can see here where I'm breaking diffeomorphism invariants. I'm introducing some walls to the box and so forth. Okay, but I should be able to do that. I mean, maybe you want to criticize the construction of a box and be asking the question of what are the degrees of freedom inside the box. But Tuff says, let's ask that question. And this is in a context where there's quantum mechanics and there's gravity and there's relativity. So it's the context of a quantum theory of gravity. Okay. Now, you might think that the following. You might think that, well, we think that physics is finite because of the discreteness from loop quantum gravity, because of any number of arguments that people have made. Okay? One can't measure an arbitrarily short distance in quantum gravity. One can't isolate something arbitrarily short. There is this scale of the Planck length below which we can't describe easily what's going on. But you might think that if we go above that, at the very least, the number of degrees of freedom should scale roughly like R over the Planck length cubed. That is, I imagine that there's something like a three-dimensional lattice. I can have 1 degree of freedom per Planck volume. And that's the number of degrees of freedom in the box. And that's what a quantum field theorist would expect. Now, what Etoff does is he argues that that's a vast overestimate. And the reason he argues that that's a vast overestimate is that you have to worry about what's the energy inside the box. And as you increase the energy, you hit a bound. And the reason is that if you put too much energy in a confined space, it, quote, and watch this little trope or this little argument because it appears all over the place. And I want to take a minute and discuss what we really mean by it. It, quote, will collapse to a black hole. Okay. Now, what that refers to is something like the following. There's a conjecture called the Fouque conjecture in classical general relativity, and there's some evidence for it, but I think it's still not a theorem. And the Fouque conjecture says that if I have an asymptotically flat solution of general relativity and it has a certain mass, and that mass is confined in a region which you can pass a hoop around, where the circumference of the hoop is r. And if the mass times Newton's constant is greater than r with some constants, then there's a horizon. What it captures is the idea that if I put too much mass in too small of a place, I get a black hole. And this can be studied in classical general relativity, and there's good evidence that it is indeed the case, that you have to formulate precisely in general relativistically what it means to have confined the mass to a small region, so there's notion of a hoop. But there is, I think, good evidence for it, and there's a theorem roughly like this of Yao, which I forget the formulation of, but which supports it. Yes?
Required to collapse. That doesn't mean that it can't exist in the first place as an initial condition before it collapses.
Yes, so watch the logic here. Okay, the assumption is that because what's really being asked is how many degrees of freedom in a stable, static situation can communicate with the outside. That's really the question that's being asked. That's the operational question. So the conclusion is that the energy of the box times Newton's constant, you know, over some power of C has to be less than R. Otherwise, everything in the box is a black hole. And if you employ that, then you come to the following conclusion. And this argument is by example. You start putting in photons of various wavelengths, or you put in a thermal distribution. And there are various ways to make this argument. The argument that you make is that the largest entropy in the box that you can make out of stuff which is not a black hole is smaller than r squared over h bar g. So there's now a set of arguments that go like the following. If I took a bunch of radiation, which is not gravitational collapse, which is way below this bound, whether thermal or otherwise, then I can consider its entropy. And the conclusion that I come to, and I'll let you fill in this argument, is that, you know, for example, the entropy, I can use the same formula as the entropy is r cubed t cubed. So if r cubed t to the fourth times g is less than r, then you can show that r cubed t cubed is less than r squared over h bar g. That's just a rearrangement.
What is the second relation?
This is that the energy, which is r cubed t to the fourth, is less than the Schwarzschild radius connected with the energy is smaller than the size of the box. Okay. Yes?
Isn't this assuming an order unity number of species?
Yes, thank you. Very good. Yes. I assuming that the constant here and here, there is a constant there proportional to the number of species. Thank you very much for that. And assuming that that is not a large number and that is not a variable number. Therefore, the conclusion is that if you have anything in the box which is not a black hole, you can, if you force it to be a black hole, it will be a black hole whose size is smaller than R, and it will be an object with entropy which is smaller than the entropy of the largest black hole that can fit in the box. In other words, the largest amount of entropy that you can have of the system in the box is if it's collapsed into a black hole and collapsed into a black hole with a Schwarzschild radius of the size of the box.
And what you argue by little hand-waving things like this, and this is all pretty hand-waving at this stage, is that any other configuration which is not a black hole has less entropy. Now, Bekenstein then argues as follows. The entropy of any configuration is a measure of how much information you would need to describe it. So he concludes that under no circumstances are more than R squared over H bar G bits of information needed to describe the physical state of the inside the box. Okay. And then he says, therefore, no matter what is in the box, assuming it's not a black hole, a complete description of what is in the box will be possible on what you could call a screen. So he says, supposing I take the walls of this box and I make little pixels with L Planck by L Planck size pixels, which could have a value 0 or 1. No matter what is in the box, a complete description of the physical state of whatever it is can be described by an array of bits on the surface of the box, one per Planck area. And therefore, he hypothesizes there exists a highly compact description of the physical state of the interior. Coded as pixels on the surface. Do you get the picture? And he hypothesizes that the most correct description of the laws of physics are going to be expressed in those variables. That is, that the correct dynamical laws are not going to be laws about fields evolving locally inside the space of the box, but are going to be laws about the evolution of this array of pixels on the surface of the box. And the description that you thought was fundamental in terms of local fields or a number of degrees of freedom proportional to the volume of the box, which is many more, much more information, because of the way that the possibility of collapse to a black hole removes most of those possible states, the remaining physically allowed states, if they're described in three dimensions, are described in a highly redundant way, and that the correct or most correct, most compact description is going to be coded onto a surface, the boundary. Yeah.
Between most compact and most fundamental, I think.
Indeed, and he claims both.
Like, for all that you say on the, that you pixelate the entire surface, is that just because we're dealing with a cube, and if you deal with a sphere or something that has a greater surface area volume ratio, you don't need the entire surface, or you need to take a slightly larger surface?
Well, what he has in mind is really a sphere, of course, because the sphere is more...
Is the maximized.
Yeah, is the maximized one. And then he says, imagine that we take the size of the region larger and larger and larger. Okay, so it becomes essentially infinite. What we're left with is just a screen. But we're left with the idea that any, and it's not a preferred one, the idea is that the description of the world in infinite three-dimensional space can be best coded into a description of dynamics of degrees of freedom on a two-dimensional plane, anywhere in that three-dimensional space. Yeah.
Do you understand why these arguments always seem to single out space versus time? Because of the black holes are time over Slim there, not time over Slim there?
The notion of a state singles out time, space versus time. I don't think this is deep. I think the notion of a space of states, of a number of degrees of freedom, are all things that are static, that are time-independent properties of a system. Maybe we want to cautiously examine them, but I think that's just where that's coming from.
If you say the holographic principle is going from a description in four dimensions to one in three, is the one that you lose necessarily space?
That's a good question. I mean, from this point of view, yes, the argument is about space. Okay, let me take one more quick comment each from a bunch of people, and then we're going to take a break. Okay, so in order, sort of going up to you.
If you look at the whole space time, then we know that we only use space time that is in that time, which is 3D. So we only have a dynamic resolution from 4D to 3D.
Yes.
So is that what it's really?
Well, so his idea, and he's very explicit about it, is that the real initial data will be on a two-dimensional plane. And just like there are equations which evolve you from the three-dimensional space-like surface into the future, if we knew the real laws of physics, it would be sufficient to give data on any two-dimensional plane. And there would be equations that give the more redundant field description we're used to in three dimensions. Yeah.
Well, just with Bouchon's comment, I think you can formulate a ECFT in a Euclidean framework, so Euclidean has the ECFT.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, then you have hyperbolic space in space time. And I think then there's no reason why you cannot single out time versus space. I mean, there's no obstruction.
Yeah, so some version of this, and I want to come later to the ADS-CFT, but you're quite right. You're quite right. Okay, some last comments, yeah.
Do we have any insight as to what the physical degree of freedom is that allows us to pick out a plane that can associate a 1 and a 0 to it?
No. No. I mean, his belief is also in passing that this is a solution to the Bell issue. That is, his belief is that this will offer a sufficiently non-local description, that what he really believed then and believes to this day is that the laws on the two-dimensional surface will be deterministic. And that's a separate issue, but just to mention, again, you know, and I think that, you know, Gerard Atope has, you know, been such, has been so right on so many things. In physics, I think he has to be taken seriously, and he has a strong point of view about this. He does not accept quantum mechanics. He believes there must be a hidden variable theory, which is deterministic, and he believes that the relationship between the fake degrees of freedom that we believe live at points in space and the real degrees of freedom which are coded on the two surface is highly non-local, and he believes that that's sufficient to account for the non-locality of quantum mechanics if the physics is deterministic on the two surface. And he has models that he develops, and there's some questions in mind. Okay, let me ask any comments, questions from Western before we take a break. Are you stunned? Okay, more is coming. Let's take a 15-minute break. Okay.